I'm and thankful for the invitation to visit with you here today. And before I get started, let me just first say that the Dr. Weber, am I echoing or is that just me? A little bit. So you'll have to guide me if I need to do something different. So, but it's primarily going to be from the perspective of matching commercial cows. So when I say commercial, I'm talking about primarily low input or moderate to low input operations. Okay, compared to more intensive operation where maybe the inputs are a little higher. In other words, more of the seed stock operation environments. Okay, so, and before the other thing I was going to try to remember, where is Dr. Smith, Mike Smith? So I appreciate your comments about Dr. Wedeman, and so I'm gonna tell everybody that I appreciate Dr. Smith as well. In my time at Missouri, he was a great mentor to me, and we ran cows together in a little cooperative between Dr. Smith, myself, and Dr. Jerry Lipsey. And many of you know Jerry Lipsey. Well, so we had a lot of fun out there at the, what do we call that place? Pierpont. Thank you. And so we had, I don't know, 30 cows between the three of us. And I remember Jerry Lipsey, Jerry Lipsey busting through the door in one of his Kramer-like entrances and saying, cows to breed tonight, be there. And so I went out there, and I remember seeing Dr. Lipsey's old red Dodge pickup parked by the barn. And I got out of my truck, Mike Smith, hood's open, Mike's leaning over the hood doing something, and I saw Jerry's feet sticking out from under the Dodge pickup. And so I walked up there and I leaned over the hood beside Dr. Smith, and I said, what's going on here? Mike said he had his, you know, low-profile, kind smile on his face, and he said, well, we forgot the Thiemann saw box, and Jerry's getting the radiator fluid to thaw semen. So we're going to talk about techniques and details. Thank you.
For that one.
Doing things right and following the protocol, Dr. Smith can teach us a lot with Dr. Lipsey's leadership. We had a lot of fun. All right, so several years ago, our extension educators challenged us to consider the vision of the beef cattle industry, and that's kind of how this presentation and the work that we've done in this area of matching cows came about. If you think about our industry's focus in the last 20 years, really since I've been paying attention, I will just say that it seems to me like our focus has been more, not solely, but more on carcass characteristics. We have been very focused on that. And it's been a good thing. It has been very good for our industry, and right now there's no question that the improvement in quality grade, for example, where 15 or 20 years ago we'd expect to get 50% of carcasses to grade choice and above, and now we're seeing 65% and above. So that focus has improved the quality of our product, and right now it's part of what is rising the tide that floats all of our boats in terms of this tremendous market that we have. So this is going to seem like a little bit negative towards that focus, and perhaps it is in a way. But what I want to do is focus on the commercial cow and matching her to forage resources and see where we're at as an industry and where we're headed. Okay, so that's going to be my focus. Before we do that, we're going to take a real quick stroll down memory lane. Dr. Rolf is a collaborator on this presentation, and she wanted me to give it down at BIF a year ago, and so I agreed for some reason to go do it down there in front of a bunch of genetics people. I'm a nutrition guy, and now do it in front of a bunch of physiologists. So I tried to check and see if they would install an exit door behind, but I'm going to have to make it to one of those to the side, I guess, if I get in too much trouble here. But so if you think back about our industry's history, and these are slides from Dr. Bob Todashek's presentation several years ago at our Oklahoma Cattlemen's Convention there in Oklahoma City. He said that in the 1940s and 50s, the industry entered into what he called an era of insanity. Okay, now, what happened? What's he talking about? Some of you are old enough to remember parts of this. Eldon, what happened?
Dwarfism.
And he remembers John Massey running all over the state of Missouri trying to cure that. Dr. John Massey. Okay, so the industry, and so what I've got here is the grand champion, Angus female at the Chicago International Expo in 1953. So the point here is that this is the premier livestock show in the world at the time. And our industry leaders decided that this animal was the best on that day. Okay, so more little and more fat was better, right? And then Dr. Todashek said that in the 1960s, the industry sort of recognized that the pendulum had swung too far. And that there was a widespread recognition for need to change. This is about the same time when the European breeds were coming into the U.S. cattle industry. And so, indeed, in terms of at least frame size, cattle moderated again. The pendulum swung back toward the middle. Now, I'm a graduate of Kansas State, and Dr. Weber and others can tell you the name of this steer. What's his name? Conoco. All right, this is the first crossbred steer / grand champion at the same premier livestock show in the world in 1969. Now, Dr. Kropp was a member of our livestock judging team, and he just retired this summer, but at this time. And he will tell you, he was in the crowd when this happened. And this, of course, is Dr. Don Good, right here, who's a longtime department head there at Kansas State. Of course, he was not at the time when he judged the show. But he made this pivotal decision on this day, and Dr. Kropp says you could have heard a pin drop. It was not a real popular decision. It was something new. Okay, but Dr. Good's message to the world was that we need to adopt this technology of crossbreeding. And it was a wonderful thing, and it was a real bold move. Then Dr. Todashek said that in the 70s and 80s, there was a return to insanity. So most of you, now some of you graduate students aren't, but most of you do remember, because I was in high school when this was going on. I remember. What happened? Yeah, the pendulum swung right through the middle. Average wasn't good enough. If a little bigger was good, a lot bigger was better. And so we went from belt buckle cattle to hat band cattle, right? And it wasn't just the show cattle, of course. It was the bulls that were popular at the time, the females. I've got literally hundreds of slides from Dr. Kropp and Dr. Todashek that are just incredible. And I always have to stop here and show you that this is one of my favorite slides, because it really points out our stubbornness in the cattle industry. How many of those people do you recognize? So unless you know what brand of jeans or color boots they wore, and actually it's a black and white picture, so forget that too. But when we take a picture in the cattle business, we stand behind the cow. It doesn't matter whether you can see the people or not, right? So it kind of demonstrates our stubbornness, which relates a lot to maybe this presentation. Then Dr. Todashek said in the 90s and 2000s, here we are, back again. The industry recognized the need to change once again. And, you know, we're having a lot of problems throughout the industry. At that point in time, a big concern was carcass size. A big concern was lack of cattle grading choice and hire because of the influx of those breeds and heavy muscle cattle, one thing and another. Fertility was a very, very serious consideration, and so on. And so here we are, at least in terms of frame size, back again to moderation. The pendulum had once again swung too far. And so my job here today is to talk about what's going on now in the cattle business, and could we fall, could we be, how's that go? We found the enemy and what? They are us, or we are it, or whatever, right? So let's just take a look and see what's going on in the industry. And so we're going to start out with Dr. Dickerson's description or job description for an efficient cow, at least in a commercial setting. Okay, and he said, early sexual maturity, high rate of reproduction, low rate of dystocia, longevity, minimum maintenance requirements, ability to convert forage resource to pounds of calf or beef. And if you sell your calves at weaning, that's a pretty darn good job description today. Would you agree? And so, you know, we could really make this a complex issue and have many other considerations if we talked about a more integrated system where we're feeding our own calves, taking advantage of carcass quality, and so on. And certainly that needs to take place. But today we're gonna look at this from the context of our many producers, high percentage of our producers that do sell their calves at weaning. So just to try to find some baseline data to indicate what's going on in commercial operations. We have a lot of breed association data, but commercial operation information is much more difficult to come by. And so we relied on these three data sets. You'll recognize those folks very well in leading all of these record-keeping efforts. And so let's just look at weaning weight and commercial cow-calf operations over time from 1991 through just last year, and the information that we could get updated here about a month ago. So what's happened in weaning weights, commercial cow-calf operations? I see some thumbs pointing up. Okay, that's Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico, standardized performance analysis data. All right, so no change over time, and you can sure see the 2011 drought. Kansas, and Dr. Weber, I don't know if you all consider that an improvement in weaning weights there in Kansas, or you call that a flat line if you were to draw a trend line through it. But certainly not a dramatic. You might argue that there's a bit of an improvement in those 3 years, but since that time period, it looks like it's certainly been flat. And then this is the North Dakota data, which is a little odd or strange yet because of the higher weaning weights early and then a decline followed by maybe just a bit of a gradual improvement over time. And like I've told the other groups, it was disappointing to me when we looked at it this way across all those data sets of hundreds of commercial cow-calf operations throughout the Great Plains region. What about weaning rate? What do you think? Nobody wants down. Brian Franken says down. Well, let's just take a quick look, and indeed, it's not different from the weaning weight story. Now, you know, some of the data we saw this morning, if you look at the overall long-term average, a recent 10-year average of the North Dakota data, it's about a weaning rate of right around 91%. That's phenomenal. And so I really don't know, Dr. Patterson, I don't know how we could improve on that a whole lot. That's really good. And that's weaning rate. That's not pregnancy rate, that's weaning rate. And then Kansas data, I think the last time I calculated that was averaging about 89. Texas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico averages about 82, give or take. So one thing that those of us in the southern Great Plains need to ask ourselves is, why are we so far behind? Because we are. We're considerably behind from a reproductive standpoint. So conferences like this are good for this kind of discussion. And we need to think long and hard about that and see if we can't catch up with our contemporaries to the north. And I know there are a lot of things that go into that, but good topic maybe for discussion tonight. Okay, let's look at it another way. Let's talk about inputs, expensive inputs. So are cattle more forage efficient? Well, it'd be difficult to measure from an overall industry standpoint, but one way Dr. Peel looked at this in our Ag Economics Department, he said, okay, let's just take our state Department of Ag information. Let's look at hay yield per acre over time. This does not include alfalfa. This is just grass hay. Okay, and so here he shows a flat line relative to hay yield. Well, you'd expect that in Oklahoma because most of our hay production is either going to be wheat in the spring, or it's going to be native grass, pasture, prairie hay, if you will. And then on the east, in the eastern tiers, there's going to be a considerable amount of Bermuda grass hay harvested. Then if you put that on a hay acres per beef cow in our beef cow inventory, look what's happened over time. It has dramatically increased. And then if you do the math and you put it on a hay tons per beef cow index, and you take a look at that, and sure, a lot of variation here in recent years, but just an incredible change. I know if I would mention hay to my grandfather, you know, his response would be something like, hay's for saddle horses. And back then, it looks like the industry, or at least Oklahoma, was averaging about 3/4 of a ton of hay per cow. Now we average somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 tons of hay per beef cow. So are cows better matched to our forage resources? If you consider hay an expensive input, it depends on where you live. It might be cheaper than leasing land. I don't know. But in Oklahoma, it's still less expensive to lease land than it is to feed hay. But our producers in this state are feeding more hay longer. And so, Ellen, apparently I'm not doing a very good job as an extension beef cattle specialist if the message is that's an expensive input. But it has changed considerably. Okay, and then let's take a look at some of the genetic trends. There you see 100 years of, what's that say, results of a century of breeding, 1835 and 1937. Dr. Wedderman, where's Dr. Wedderman? Do you remember that name of that steer? I'm not implying anything. What? The front one, I wouldn't have a clue about the back one. So anyway, this is an Oklahoma State steer, right? And our herdsman showed him up there at the Chicago International. Jupiter? Something orange. It's not Agent Orange, I'm sure, but there's something orange in his name. I can't remember it right now. Dr. Kropp can tell you all about it, but so let's just take a look at some of these characteristics and see what's going on now relative to change and consider our industry's history as we do that. So this is the crossbreed adjusted, most recently reported, crossbreed adjusted EPDs for milk yield in some of the beef breeds. And I've only put a few up here so it didn't get too busy. Only one of the breeds shown here has sort of pulled back on milk yield over time. And of course, that's the Simmental breed. Why would they do that? They came into the U.S. as a dual-purpose breed, right? And everybody knew, well aware, that they had probably more milk than they needed for our forages here in the United States. It's interesting to see what's going on with the other breeds. It looks like we continue to aggressively select for milk yield, more aggressively in some breeds than others. I'm going to give you just a few reasons here in a minute to sort of suggest that I think if you look at the idea of crossbreeding and optimizing genetic power, if you will, with forage resources, the Hereford breed is actually in a pretty good position right now. And they are rapidly trying to catch up with everyone else, right? But it's interesting to look and see that the new Hereford is pretty close to the old Angus. And the new Angus is, and in fact, last year we said they had finally eclipsed Simmental cattle in milk yield. Can't say that this year, but they're really close. All right, so you just can't think about the breeds today like I did 20 years ago. You know, they are different. They're very different than they were then. And this is just one of the reasons why. Okay, so, and if you think about crossbreeding, I'm going to show you the Angus's optimal milk module in a minute. It says at our operation, we need to aim for somewhere right in here. Well, if you take a crossbred from that to nearly any one of those breeds, from the Hereford breed to any one of those breeds, you're going to wind up somewhere there in the middle. So if you need a quick fix in terms of overdoing milk production, you know, that might be one way to solve it. So three things relative to milk production why this is a concern. Number one, it's been reported a number of times, and that is that there's a strong positive relationship between milk yield and maintenance requirements. And those are with you 365 days out of the year, not just when they're lactating. Also, related to that, you get greater visceral organ mass with more milk production. Think of the Holstein cow. Okay, how do they yield when you hang them up on the rail? Not very well. And it's because they have tremendous visceral organ mass. It takes a lot of expensive metabolic machinery to produce 100 to 150 pounds of milk a day, right? Okay, so that is one issue, just the maintenance requirement associated with milk production and continuing to select for more. Okay, this is an older experiment that kind of looks at the efficiency, depending on where you start, at continuing to select for more milk. Okay, so here in the Lewis paper, they've got a set of cows that started out with relatively low milk production. And if you continue to select for more milk in that group, the conversion of milk to calf weaning weight was pretty good. It was about almost 12 pounds of milk to 1 pound of calf weaning weight. If you started out in the middle group of cows that had moderate milk to begin with, push for more, your conversion was somewhere in the neighborhood of 15 pounds of milk to additional pound of calf weaning weight. If you started out with a lot of milk and you continued to select for more, or at least the regression analysis on that set of cows, the conversion was 52 to 1. Okay, so not very efficient. Well, if you think about this for a minute, what's going on? What's not included here? What are those calves consuming? These calves. A lot of grass. These probably aren't consuming very much grass. And so really what we're doing here, and the reason that the conversion looks so poor, is because we're just swapping grass for milk. And so you have to ask yourself, how efficient is that? And this is just the data combining three of those studies and averaging all three of them. They're all older experiments published in the Journal of Animal Science, and they all say the same thing. Pretty much the same kind of relationship. So then, third issue. You know, I think Dr. Wells heard me say down there in Ardmore, where are we headed with milk production? When are we going to get there? You know, how much do we really need? And so this is the question we all need to be asking ourselves in our own states, and that is there a limit of milk production that your forage can support? Is there a limit? And so if you think about taking the top DHIA cow from, say, Michigan, that gives maybe 150 pounds of milk, you take her out of her freestall barn and her 50% concentrate diet, 50% corn silage diet, and you bring her down to your country, or Zach, turn her out on your place with old native grass and 2 pounds of 38% cubes, what's going to happen to her milk production? Well, it'll plummet, right? It definitely will. And So, you know, obviously that's not a change in her genetic capacity. It's just a change in her environment. And so, could that be happening in the industry now? Dr. Mike Brown's data from USDA station down at El Reno says that it is happening. And this is from Brangus cows, and he had a set of cattle down there with a wide range of milk EPD in that breed. And what his data shows is, regardless of the month that he collected the milk production data, is once you got somewhere around 4 to 5 pounds of milk EPD, or that's kilogram of milk EPD equivalent, you maxed out on actual milk yield. There was a limit to what the forage could produce. And so what you have here from the cattle representing the genetics from here to the right is you have a more expensive factory producing no more widgets, right? If milk yield and continued selection for milk yield is related to higher maintenance requirements, perhaps the pendulum is swinging too far. Increasing risk or frequency of cases where forage resources limit the expression of genetic potential, and perhaps, just perhaps, production costs have increased because the environment has been artificially modified in many cases to fit the kind of cows that we like. All right, so what do you do? How do you know where you should be headed? And Angus Association has a wonderful tool called the Optimal Milk Module, and you can see on their website where you can get to that. And if I plug in our data for our commercial cow-calf operation west of Stillwater here, what I come up with is a range of EPDs of around 15 to 19 in the Angus breed of where we should be aiming. And let me tell you, it's hard to find bulls with that kind of range. So something that kind of an eye-opener. All right, now let's just talk about some of the other characteristics, and I'll blend these together with mature size, muscle, and growth real quick. Looks like, Britt, are you keeping track of me here? This thing keeps going off, so I don't know if I... Okay, thank you. So I hope, if you think about our history, you'll look at this slide and you'll realize that we are right in the middle of a never-ending arms race for growth. And perhaps we need to be asking ourselves, you know, is there a limit? Does that represent eventually the pendulum swinging too far from a biological standpoint? So let's just talk about cow size, and I'm just showing you the Angus data here because it's readily available. But you see the trend for mature weight in Angus cows is increasing, perhaps not dramatically, if you just look at the axis over here on the left, but it's increasing. What's interesting to note is that genetic trend for mature height has been flat since 1987. So weight's going up, but once we came back to moderation in frame size, it looks like we've decided to stay there. How big are they now? This is the germplasm GPE Project Meat Animal Research Center data, cycle 7. And, you know, it's just, when I show this to our producers, there's many of them that haven't followed this are kind of shocked. That is that the Hereford cows are bigger than Angus, and Red Angus are bigger than the Simmental, bigger than the Limousine, bigger than the Charlotte. Now, that's the F1 crosses. But it's a surprise to a lot of people. Our cows are pretty big, and all of the data that the extension specialists across the country have reported suggest that our commercial cow size is approaching 1,400 pounds. So what about muscling then? And this is just these English breeds and Brangus relative to ribeye area. If we were to include Limousine, Charlotte, some of the European breeds, their genetic trend or their EPDs would be much higher still. But we're also rapidly and aggressively selecting for muscle. And so this is another characteristic that we need to, sit back and think, well, what's this going to do eventually to our commercial cow herd? So if we ask that question, how will it impact their matching ability? When we looked through the literature a year ago, the answer was really, if we continue to select for more muscle over time, it wasn't terribly clear. I thought maybe we'd see a dramatic increase in maintenance requirements due to heavy muscle cattle. But Eldon, apparently it's not all that dramatic relative to maintenance requirements. Okay, they do go up slightly, according to Dr. Farrell. You do get increased mature weight. And the reason is more muscle equals less fat at the same live weight, and I'll show you that in a graph here in just a minute. Dr. Mike Tess said in 2002 in a review paper, he said undesirable associations between maternal traits and retail product appear to be mediated through fat thickness. Okay, so that would be the concern. Lower adipose composition is associated with older age at puberty, lower conception rate, lower calving rate, according to Splann and others. So that would be a concern, most definitely. But let me just show you how the body composition thing works. This is percent of empty body weight over here on this axis. Then I've just got either theoretically conditioned score or live weight here. And these are the equations from the 2000 beef cattle NRC. Okay, the equation for total body mass in terms of protein and total body mass in terms of fat. Okay, and so somewhere right in here, pretty close to where those lines cross, is a body condition score of 5, approximately. And as you heard this morning, and we teach our extension educators and our producers, you know, we'd like for a cow to calve in a body condition score of 5. That's kind of our magical limiter threshold relative to the drivers of the hypothalamic pituitary axis, right? And so that's kind of where the rubber meets the road. Well, if you continue to select for muscle over time, what happens is you shift the red line up, right? And so where those lines cross now, if that's, say, 15% body fat, something's got to give. And so fat goes down at the same live weight. If you're going to reach the magical threshold of body condition score 5, she's got to be bigger. She has to weigh more. Right? All you're doing is diluting the fat with more muscle. So when you dilute it, you have to make her bigger to get the fat back. And so that's why our cows continue to get bigger, probably, or one large reason, that and visceral organ mass, why they continue to get heavier but not taller. Okay, real simple analysis of, you know, on commercial cow-calf operations, we looked at several operations, looked back through the literature to see if we could find this relationship between just cow size and weaning weight. And the interesting thing to me is when you look at that, initially it looks like somebody nailed it with a 12 gauge, which says there's not a very strong relationship to begin with. But it is significant. It says that for every additional 100 pounds of cow weight in this data set, you get about 6 pounds of additional calf weaning weight. Not terribly exciting. And then this publication said 4 pounds per 100 pounds of cow weight. This one said 6 pounds. This is Gant Maurer's data. Chelsea Dobbs data, another 6 pounds per 100 pounds of cow weight. And then recently, Shane Gadbury published this one from Arkansas, cow herd at 15 pounds of calf weaning weight per 100 pounds of cow weight. So maybe there are some environmental differences from operation to operation, and that number is going to vary some. So we asked Dr. Damona Doy, what is it going to cost to keep that extra 100 pounds of cow around? And In her enterprise analysis, she said, she ran that through and said it's going to cost about $42 to get that 6 to 15 pounds of additional calf weaning weight. Growth and feed intake, real quick, nutritionist view. You know, what we're probably doing when we just select for growth, one of three things here. We're either selecting for more intake, more consumption, and if you own a feed yard, that's a good thing. The more the cattle eat above their maintenance requirements, the better your feed efficiency is going to look. The more you can dilute the maintenance requirements with gain, the more profitable, generally speaking, that set of cattle is compared to its contemporaries. NEM is lower. We might be selecting cattle that have lower maintenance requirements. We might. That might also be going on, okay? We also might actually be improving the utilization of net energy, okay? And that's what we want. That's really what we want to happen, or one or both of those last two. The problem is there's a positive genetic correlation between growth and feed intake. Okay, that probably goes without saying. But here's the kicker. Increased feed intake and gut capacity results in increased visceral organ mass relative to live body weight, just like milk. The GI and liver make up less than 10% of the cow's body mass. But guess what? The GI and liver combine to use 40 to 50% of the total energy expenditure in a beef cow. Now, yes, I'm a nutritionist, and this kind of stuff is pretty cool to me. But you know what? It's important. 70% of the energy that goes into produce a pound of beef comes from cow maintenance. It's a big deal. What we've been doing, I think, and another area where we... this is the part where I need to identify the exit. Gant, clear the way back there. But we've been teaching guidelines based on conditions that reflect a nutrient status that maximizes reproductive performance. Basically, we are teaching our producers to always fear reproductive failure. More recently here, I've heard several breeders say, well, you know what, maybe an 85% pregnancy rate in my seed stock cows, or an 80, is not a bad thing. And what are they really saying? They're really saying, well, I'm going to weed out the cows that don't match. And I'm going to make them show me that they can survive and thrive in my environment. Not based on their numbers, but based on their actual performance from a fertility standpoint. Major limitation is focus on those short-term effects. In other words, how many cows are pregnant this year? And perhaps we overlook the long-term implications. Okay, this is Dr. Andy Roberts' statement, and I think it really kind of says the same thing. He says, feeding to maximize reproductive rate does not result in differential retention between females with high and low feed requirements. In contrast, managing cows under reduced feed inputs would more likely result in culling of cows with high feed requirement due to reproductive failure. Okay, so tough times don't last, but tough cows do. I always wind this up in our when I'm talking to our producers by kind of giving them some tips, and you're going to recognize these. This is nothing new to any of you. But I think the key here is it requires a long-term commitment. Like we heard this morning, you know, fertility is not very highly heritable, but it is heritable. And there, you know, obviously much of fertility is defined or determined more by management. But moderate size, milk, and muscle make a lot of sense if you're trying to match your cows to forage resources, rather than getting caught up in the pendulum and riding it all the way to the end. Okay, cull open cows, being willing to challenge them, resist the temptation to gradually modify the environment. I suspect that a lot of our producers, feed costs and their management has gradually changed over time because they're too afraid of extremely low reproductive rates. Now, maybe that philosophy has all changed in the new environment we live in. When our guys are making $600 or $700 a cow, you can afford to spend more money for those pregnancies. Keep only early born heifers. We heard that this morning. Keep only early bred heifers. Keep or buy bulls out of cows that always calve early. A lot of new tools that are available and being worked on that should improve our position in this, that should help us to keep from going over the cliff, if you will, or swinging the pendulum too far. So I encourage our producers to find a source of seed stock that puts priority on these those economically relative traits related to fertility. This is not a very popular thing to say, and it's hard to sell cattle that don't look very good. It's kind of a problem we have. We have a marketing interest or objective combined with a production interest or objective, and they really don't go very well together. So purchase bulls out of cows that are managed like yours are, or worse. In other words, try to find someone who manages their cattle like you do so that you can be confident that those cattle will thrive in your environment. So no strong evidence that commercial cow efficiency is improved from a commercial cow-calf perspective. In some cases, in some traits, the industry is on an unsustainable path. Cows are not getting taller. They are getting bigger. We can't seem to get enough milk, muscle, or growth. The result, I think, is that indeed, on an industry average perspective, input feed costs per cow-calf unit are increasing, while limited data suggests that production actually is not. Very good. Now, is there anybody that's not mad? Okay. Oh, you're not mad, Dr. Weber. Thank you. Maybe I've done a good job. I'll think of something before the end of the day. Okay? So thank you for the invitation, Megan. I've gone over my time, so